gentlemen, welcome back for another episode of One Perfect Game, the show about video games and the people who play them. My name is Matt Tilby. It is great to have you join us today, and me and my guest, I should say, for this episode. She is an Australian voice actor who has featured in a number of recent games, including Loopmancer, Cloudpunk, City of Ghosts, and Age of Darkness Final Stand, as well as podcasts like The Strata and Out of Place. She's also an accomplished actor and theatre performer with credits in performances both in Australia and in England, where she now resides. I am, of course, delighted to welcome the one and only Rhiannon Marshall to the show. Rhiannon, welcome on in. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. That was a hell of an introduction. Thanks.
Yeah, I seem to get that from a lot of my guests over the sort of the lifetime of the show. They've been like, oh, your intro is quite sort of long-winded is probably not the best way to describe it, but very descriptive.
In a very good way. It's nice. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's obviously a lot of the sort of work you've done. There's obviously a lot to cover, and it's hard to sort of, I guess, put all of that into one sort of small introduction. But I should point out for people listening at home, this podcast invitation and guesting was sort of brought about by probably the weirdest 6 degrees of separation I think you could probably think of. I found out about Rhiannon's work through Age of Darkness being shown at PAX Australia last year, and it sort of brought about me figuring out that I was best friends with her brother in primary school almost about sort of 20 years ago.
So
shout out to Brennan, wherever you are. Hope you're well, good sir. But yeah, how you been? It's an interesting sort of period for you, I guess, in between a bunch of acting and voice acting roles. How have things been?
Yeah, really good, thanks. I'm busy. I'm very, very busy and very grateful to be busy.
Yeah, I can imagine. It seems like a very sort of interesting, you know, role and sort of position to work in voice acting, as well as obviously voiceover work. And I think, as I said, I found out about your work through Age of Darkness being shown last year. And I guess, what was it like working with the team at Playside? It must have been nice to get that little slice of home working with an Australian team for once.
Oh, they're amazing. I cannot praise the crew at Playside enough. They are very passionate. And, you know, as a fellow Australian, you understand, like, it's really, really hard for Australians to get games out there, like from indie to AAA. Mm. Doesn't matter how big they are. It's such a competitive market. And yet everything Australia produces is of such a high quality. And Playside is no exception. It's honestly an absolute joy to work with them. I've worked with them on a couple of projects. They're so easy to work with. They're incredibly in-depth in their direction. Like, their ideas for characters are so comprehensive that the sessions, you might only have 30 lines on the page, but we will take 3 hours to do those 30 lines because we are going to dig through every tiny aspect. So it's an absolute joy to work with them.
Yeah, I can imagine those sorts of sessions can be, yeah, quite long and quite sort of I guess interesting to go through, but I guess the sort of end result is always a really high quality, you know, game, I guess, and that's, you know, for every sort of voice actor. But I guess obviously you've done a lot of voice acting, but also some voiceover work in the last couple of years, I guess, with the likes of Microsoft and Fujifilm and even the city of Tampa Bay, which I thought was a very interesting position to have. But what's the preparation and planning like, I guess, for each particular role? I guess obviously you're shifting quite a bit from voice acting to voiceover work to podcasting and all that sort of stuff. I guess, do they tend to vary from role to role? I guess the prep work from each might be a little bit different. How does that look?
Yes, you're spot on. It is very different across the job, and even within the same genres. So I work across commercial, corporate, e-learning, audiobooks, games, a little bit of animation, and even within the genres. So, for example, you might be given a script ahead of time for a game. Sometimes you don't get the script ahead of time. You only get it once the session starts. Sometimes you self-direct at home and send them the audio, they give you some feedback, and you re-record. Sometimes it's a live session, sometimes it's an in-studio session. So you have to be incredibly flexible, and you have to be prepared to take criticism on the fly, to change on a dime, because sometimes you'll record something and they'll simply turn around and tell you, nope, that's all wrong. And you have to have the ability in a moment to go, okay, well, what do you want and how can I apply that instantly and give you exactly what you're asking for? Commercials tend to be a little more brutal, I would say. I think directors in games and animation and the more creative storytelling fields are quite gentle or aware that they're working with actors, and they try to say things in interesting and kind ways. When you're in a commercial session, there's usually 10 people on the line, like two are the client, one's a producer, one's in charge of the money, one's a director, and they all want something different. And they're all sitting there, and every time you do something, you know, three people will be like, oh, I love that. And then two other people will be like, that was disgusting. I hated it. And so you're balancing all of these sort of opposing opinions. And in the meantime, also remembering, like, you just got to get the job done. Like, you can't take anything personally. Whereas game sessions and e-learning sessions, less pressurized sessions, when there's, to be fair, less money involved, people are much more chill, relaxed. It's usually a lot of fun. If you're voicing games, for example, that tends to be a lot more strenuous. I play a lot of screaming sort of roles. So there's a sort of prepping for that requires a little more vocal rest, a little more relaxation, a little more awareness of technique to ensure I don't lose my voice.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess, like, with those voice roles, how much leeway, I guess, are you given to add your own sort of personal touches? Obviously, I'd assume you'd be working with, yeah, a director or someone similar. But are you able to add your own sort of certain flourishes, or is it still very much by the book?
Yes, it depends on the project. So commercials, of course, absolutely the script. Each word has been chosen by hand so carefully. Same with sort of explainers, anything corporate, somebody has poured the exact right language into it. So there is absolutely no variation from the script. And often even the punctuation, like if they put a full stop, you take a full stop. If they put a comma, you better breathe there. whereas games, it's usually a much more collaborative process. Particularly sometimes what happens is a script will be written by, for example, an Australian writer might write an American role. And I had this recently where I was recording something and I was recording in an American accent and I knew straight away that this was an Australian writer because there was so much Australian vernacular in it. So on the fly, I changed a few words because it said mate a couple of times, which doesn't sound right in the American accent. So I changed it to buddy so that it still had that flow. And sometimes in a session, I'll just be like, ooh, can I try something? And often the director's like, yeah, go for it. And I'll do a line and add a bit or, alter the line because I was like, oh, this feels more in character. And they've always been very happy about it. Writers and directors are always really excited when you're passionate about the project as well. So it you do often get quite a bit of leeway.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's a little bit more flexibility in those sorts of roles, which is always something that I've wondered, I guess, having spoken to people in both voice acting and voiceover roles. So it's always good to hear that there's a little bit of opportunity to rework things and make things a little bit of your own. I guess, is there a particular role or, you know, position that you'd like to see yourself working in? Is there a dream role for yourself, I guess, in the next couple of years?
Oh, that's a great question. Honestly, I feel like everything I land is a bit of a dream role at the moment because just a few years ago I wasn't doing this. And it was only because of the pandemic sort of forcing me to look at other avenues that I ended up here. So I feel like, of course, like in a perfect dream, like dream world, I would love to do like, you know, a massive RPG, like a beloved character in one of those sprawling RPGs. But having said that, I keep, like, you land a job and you go, God, I didn't even know I wanted this and now I have this and I love it. Mm. Like, I wanted Aelys in Age of Darkness. The second I read her, I was like, ooh, I want this. I want this really bad. and I got her and thank goodness. And she's been such an amazing journey for me and still ongoing as well, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned how, like, you'd only sort of started this sort of voice acting journey, I guess, through the start of the pandemic a couple of years back. What were you doing before then? And how did that sort of, you know, become this voice acting journey? And how did that start?
Well, I was primarily working in theatre. I mostly did musical theatre, and I'd done a stint in Japan at Universal Studios, and I come back, and to be honest, I was really struggling to sort of find my place in the industry here in the UK, and I was feeling so disheartened. And as terrible as this sounds, when the pandemic hit and everything closed down, I felt a weird sense of relief, and I knew that was a bad sign, because you shouldn't feel good when the world shuts down. Obviously, people horribly suffering aside, that was awful. But and it made me sort of reassess, like, oh, I don't think I like what I do anymore. and I'd done a little bit of, for fun, like amateur audio drama work with a mate of mine who's a writer, Kieran Davey. He's amazing. And he writes The Penny Peep Show. And he'd invited me to just have fun. And he writes these amazing comedies. There's so many of them if you check out The Penny Peep Show. And he just let me come in and just play. And I he said to me, and, you know, he's a dear friend, and he said to me, he's like, you're really good at this. You're really good at this. And I was like, oh, you know, maybe I'll give it a go. And then when the pandemic hit, I was fortunate to be stable enough that I had a little bit of money. I invested in my booth, my equipment, and took some classes online. And by the end of 2020, I started auditioning for things. And by 2021, I was working full time. So it kind of just snowballed from there, and this just feels right. It feels like we're meant to be.
Yeah, it seems like you've found your niche, definitely, and I'm glad you have. But I mean, it's interesting how big the role of voice acting has become, especially in the last few years. And what I guess aspects of the profession do you find that you're still coming to grips with, if there are any?
Ooh, well, I suppose one of the greatest things I think about, particularly voicing for games, I'll say, is there are so many games being made now. Everybody's making a game. There are so many indie devs, so many opportunities to play. And we live, the pandemic sort of really challenged both devs and commercial and corporate employers to consider remote talent. So that's working from home in your home-built booth. Mm. Whereas previously, you were in studio more. You were called into a major city, say, over here, like London. Now, since the pandemic, a lot of stuff has gone back into studio. So particularly in the States, a lot of anime dub was recorded remotely throughout the pandemic, and now it's all gone back to studio, which is quite disappointing for a lot of people who don't live in LA, can't afford to live in LA or Texas, because that's where else it gets recorded. So dealing with, I suppose, balancing in-studio sessions, like what you can achieve and what you can't achieve from a remote booth, can be a little challenging sometimes, but it's doable. I'm here to say it's doable, and I'm making it work. So you don't have to live in a hub city to work. You just have to accept that you might do different jobs.
Oh, okay. And I guess that moves us on quite nicely, I guess, to the final part of this discussion on voice acting, I guess. For those people, I guess, looking to explore that world of voice acting or voiceover work, what sort of advice or guidance would you give to people starting out on that journey?
Well, my first piece of advice to most people is get acting lessons, because it's acting. And you don't have to go to an expensive school. You don't have to go nuts. You can just join like an online improv class, like just dip your toe in and start playing. However, I do say, if you're Australian, do yourself a favor and learn a really good general American accent or a good neutral British accent, because unfortunately there's not a whole lot of work for Australians, our accent specifically. So, you know, get good at that. Otherwise, it's so accessible. I will say, if you are interested, start investing. Setting up a booth doesn't have to break the bank. Like, you can get a high-end booth for, like, you know, $5,000 or £5,000, or you can build one like me that's made out of PVC pipes and acoustic blankets, and this cost me like £300. And I record broadcast commercials in here, so it's obviously fine. Start looking at training online. There are a lot of great places. I trained with Gravy for the Brain, which is a weird name, but it's a really, really good subscription service. You pay £30 and they give you like an incredible array archive of lessons, pre-recorded lessons, and you can consume them at your own pace. They teach you how to edit your audio, how to make your own reels, how to read a script, how to good mic technique, where to stand. So yeah, just start learning. There is really nothing stopping you. Obviously, there's a little bit of financial investment, but if you want it, go for it.
That is perfect advice. And I guess now we move on to the second portion of the podcast, Rhiannon. It's basically where we invite the guest to explore their formative years in gaming. And I guess, what was that like for you? I mean, have you got a particular first memory of a game or a first console that you had? How did that look for you starting out?
Ugh, I was born in 1990, to reveal my age, but gosh, what a time. I was very lucky that my parents had invested in a couple of PCs and games at the time. And not just games, but like fun adventure games. We grew up playing a lot of Sierra point-and-click adventures, like the King's Quest games, the Space Quest games, also LucasArts games like Monkey Island, Full Throttle. And I'm the middle of five kids, so we had like one PC for us, all of us, and it was sort of like in the kitchen.
Oh, wow. And
you'd come home and like one person would get on and the others would sit in like a ring of chairs behind them, like watching. So it was a very collaborative sort of experience. And my older brother had a Sega in his room that we were allowed to play sometimes if he was kind enough to let us. And that was great. So that was like Street Fighter and Sonic. I was obsessed with Sonic. I was going to marry Sonic. That's what I was convinced of at the age of six. And it was incredibly important, I think, to my education. And sort of my problem solving, this sounds ridiculous, but I think I was better at school because we were playing all these puzzle games and all of these lateral thinking games and narrative games as well. I became really obsessed with storytelling, and I think games were a big part of that.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the sort of, you know, everyone makes that joke about, oh, mum said it's my turn on the computer now, or mum said it's my turn on the Xbox now, to sort of hear that being as the sort of formative, you know, introduction for people to video games is always quite funny, I guess, in that regard. But it's also interesting how you sort of mentioned games helping you out at school and sort of letting that creative, you know, that creative idea flourish. I remember, like, I'm the sort of person who, like, I'll say it to anyone within earshot, you know, Super Mario 64 was my first game, and it helped me sort of discover that love for video games and discover that, you know, the sort of hand-eye coordination and sort of that active thinking and awareness was so key to who I am today and how I learn and think. So I'm definitely in the same boat in that regard. But as you sort of got older, like you sort of mentioned, you know, the Segas and your PC, and did you sort of move on to like the 64 or the PS1? What was that sort of next step for you?
We were a PlayStation family, not a Nintendo family.
Okay. I know,
pretty intense. Brennan got a Game Boy, which I was very jealous of. He had a Game Boy Color. So, and that's back when we didn't buy the games. We would rent them from Video Easy. And
yes.
So you'd get Pokemon Blue and you'd get as far as, like, I don't know, Viridian City or something. And then you'd have to, like, give it back. And then, you know, someone else would save over and you never got very far. It was ridiculous. But I do remember we played Final Fantasy VIII, which I was obsessed. Like, that blew my mind. I was already learning Japanese at school, as we all did. and sort of that introduction to Japanese culture through gaming spurred me on to be obsessed with Japan and eventually live there. I think that... Oh, and also we ended up becoming really obsessed with like online forums, looking for games to try. And I got into like Azure Dreams, which was like a JRPG-esque tower crawler, like dungeon crawler game.
Okay.
Just obscure things that, bless my parents, like my dad would come home from business trips to Asia with bootleg copies of these games that just you could not find anywhere in Australia, because, you know, Australia is a nightmare for sourcing games anyway. And it just kept going. It very much snowballed. And then RPGs became my obsession with things like Baldur's Gate and Neverwinter Nights. And that obsession exists today.
Yeah, no, our family has definitely been the same in terms of, they'd come home from trips to Bangkok and Kuala Lumpur with, like, you know, pirated copies of, you know, I remember Grand Theft Auto 3 and yeah. and like Wipeout and things like that. For the purposes of any Australian Federal Police listening, that is a joke. Definitely.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, this is all just for parody. Wink, wink.
Rhetoric.
Yeah. But it's interesting how, especially around sort of the late 90s and early 2000s, how Australian and US culture was being so caught up in that wave of you know, Japanese and sort of Asian games and culture. Like, I remember I was huge on Pokemon as well. Like, the first Pokemon game I got was Gold for Christmas 2000. And I remember playing that for hours on end for that sort of first week and sort of definitely going back to it a lot over the next couple of years. As well as, like, I watched Digimon quite a bit. I played Digimon World for hours on end and just that the sort of anime and kids anime sort of in that sort of, you know, late 90s, early 2000s era was definitely all the rage for kids my age. But was that something that you, I guess, stayed true to, I guess, even to now? Like that sort of Japanese culture and sort of, you know, those sorts of games, is it something that you still really enjoy?
Oh, yes. Yeah, very much so. I wish I played more games. I really wish I could get into Final Fantasy Online. I'm just so bad at committing to MMOs. I was the same. I feel like any Australian kid. I feel very privileged to grow up where I did through the, like, boom of, for kids, like, the dubs, like Sailor Moon, Digimon, Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah.
And then you had Adult Swim on weekends at night playing things like Trigun and this amazing stuff. And then Final Fantasy. When Final Fantasy X came out, like, I lost my mind. I was obsessed. Absolutely obsessed. Adored it. We played Final Fantasy VIII so much that we damaged one of the discs, because this was back when it had like seven discs. And I remember we couldn't get past one part because we couldn't repair that disc, and it was heartbreaking.
Oh no.
The obsession with, but like, so I played the heck out of like the first, I don't know, like 40 minutes of the game before I, you know, over and over again, kept breaking. But yes, it's followed me through. I went on to work in Japan. I continued to study Japanese through high school. So I'd say it had a massive influence on my life and where I wanted to be. And, you know, while I was living in Japan, I went to a Yoshitaka Amano art gallery viewing, and he did all the original art for the Final Fantasy games.
Oh, wow.
And there were
yeah.
his paintings, like, for sale. And I was tempted at the time to, like, sink all my savings, like $20,000 into, like, a Yoshitaka Amano original, because I was like, it's worth it. I didn't, which is probably good. I bought a house instead, so that was important.
Oh, good,
but,
yeah.
You see, it was a trade-off, but, like, standing there in front of that art, and I have the poster that, like, they gave you a free poster at the exhibit up on my wall at the moment of the Water Warrior, which is Tidus from Final Fantasy X, the original art with Yuna. And so beautiful. The storytelling, so beautiful. Yeah, the obsession is still alive.
That's very good to hear, and I'm glad that you made the right choice in purchasing a house. So that could have gone either way, to be honest. But
really could have.
I guess before we sort of move into what you're, I guess, currently playing or what you've been playing in the last couple of years, I guess having that sort of interaction with voice acting and sort of working with games both big and small, has that sort of the work you've been doing in voice acting inspired you to sort of check out more sort of indie games as well? What's that sort of been like for you?
Yes, very much so. It really opened my eyes to the indie scene, because I wasn't particularly on my radar, which I feel terrible about. I played a few indie games that had gone like viral and I'd heard a lot about, but now, oh my gosh, like, there are indie games pouring out of everywhere, and I'm excited and about trying all of them, not just ones I've worked on, but it has opened up, particularly on Twitter for me, like, this whole stream of amazing people all these indie devs, sometimes just one or two people, sometimes a slightly bigger team. I'm support so many Kickstarters now. Like, I am Kickstarting so many indie games just because it's so exciting. It's an amazing time for indie games, and it's really hard work. And I suppose being on the other side has brought me this appreciation. Like, I've seen the devs firsthand pour, you know, years of their life into a single project to just launch it on Steam and hold their breath. And sometimes things go really well, sometimes they don't. And the fact that they just sort of go, all right, I'm going to keep going, and they make something else, and they grow, and the stories are interesting, and oh my gosh, I could talk about indie game devs forever. They're absolute heroes. And yes, being a voice actor has made me appreciate their work far more, and I play a lot more indie games now.
That is a relief. Having, you know, worked for a mobile dev quite recently, I feel the same way, sort of getting an appreciation once you sort of, you know, look behind the curtain and see how hard they work for their craft and what they, you know, strive to release. It definitely brings a new level of appreciation, I guess, for what they've been able to achieve. So I definitely agree in that part. But yeah, I guess, you know, what have you been playing now, I guess, you know, with the PS5 and the Switch and, you know, the Xbox coming out, there's obviously a lot more choice. Are you, you know, playing plenty of console games, or are you definitely more in the PC realm?
I am a PC girl through and through, mostly, I would say. I got a Switch last year for my birthday, which I'd wanted for a very long time. So that helped me get back into. So I've been playing a lot of, like, comfort games like Animal Crossing, and I've played Pokemon Arceus on it, because that was my first Pokemon game I've played since Silver.
Oh, wow.
How long it had been since I'd played a Pokemon game, because I just didn't have... I didn't have a console, and I was previously a starving actor, so you don't really have money to spend on games. I'm very happy to be in a different field now where I can, you know, afford to buy games. I'm also playing on PC. Like, I play quite a bit of Dead by Daylight, which isn't good for my mental health. What else am I playing at the moment? Two Point Hospital. I'm in a bit of a casual game moment. What games have I finished recently? Over Christmas, I finally played XCOM 2 on the Switch.
Okay.
Which was a little buggy on the Switch, bless them. Obviously, porting it to Switch is a really... I also now appreciate how hard it is to, like, multi-console, like, multi-platform your game. Like, it's insane.
Mm. Yeah.
I understand why devs avoid it until they've got success, and then they might port it to Switch, because it's not easy. I also, what have I been playing? Oh, my gosh. I've been bits and pieces, a lot of casual gaming. I replayed some Mass Effect over the Christmas period, and I finally played Doki Doki Literature Club, which I've been putting off because, you know, that's nightmarish. Little bits and pieces games. I replayed The Wonderful Unpacking.
That game is phenomenal.
Tears every time. And I can't... Brisbane devs, I met them at PAX and totally embarrassed myself. Like, I basically cried in front of them. And I was like, can I get a photo because I love your game? And bless them, they were very kind. And they're like, okay, you're all right. Calm down. You know, absolutely phenomenal. BAFTA winning, obviously. Just brilliant game. Yeah, I think that's all I'm playing at the moment. I'll remember in a second and I'll shout it mid-conversation.
No, that's perfectly fine. Of course, you did mention Mass Effect there, and this is particularly a bit of a departure for the podcast, as we normally tend to talk about one game. But I guess in a break from tradition, we are discussing a number of games. What have you chosen for us today, Rihanna?
I have chosen the Mass Effect trilogy. I'm sorry, because I was like, how do I pick one? It's kind of a... it's an overarching thing, and I swear there's a reason for the overarchingness, which I'll explain, but the Mass Effect trilogy is what I would like to deep dive today.
Well, I think it's interesting that you chose the trilogy apart from one, you know, one of the three games. I do agree, like, you can't really talk about one without talking about sort of the rest of the games linked to it, because I feel like you said, it's an overarching sort of story and sort of and gameplay and how it plays. But it's like, I was one of the few people, I guess, who probably played two first and then went back to number one. And it was night and day. Like, I thought, I thought, you know, getting lost in the Citadel, and I was just like, I can't. I just can't deal with this, and immediately went to, and after, you know, the sort of number two starts, and it's like a million miles an hour, and it's like there's so much happening, and it's like this is so much better personally. But how was your
totally
introduction?
Agree.
What was your introduction to it, I guess? Like, were you someone who played it when it first came out, or were you sort of more introduced to it a little bit later?
Well, this is part of why this series is so special to me, is how it came into my life, which was I was at university. I hadn't really played any games for a few years. Like, high school was really tense, as it is for a lot of people, and I sort of had to drop all the things that kind of made me happy, you know, all hobbies, because I was working my butt off. And, like, I topped a lot of my subjects, but, like, what for when you look back? But anyway, I was having a hard time in Australia, so I decided to go on exchange to the University of Exeter in England for a year to finish my degree here, and just to basically get away. And I moved in across the hall from this guy, and as I walked past his room, I saw he had this souped-up desktop computer, and I was very jealous because I'd just brought my shitty little laptop that, you know, couldn't run anything. And I stopped in the hallway, and I was like, hey, that's a really cool PC. And he was like, oh yeah, do you game? And I was like, no, I haven't for a while. And he was like, well, I've got a bunch of games on here. I'll leave my door unlocked when I'm at class and you can come in and play. And I was like, holy shit, wow, okay, thanks. And he had Mass Effect and Dragon Age. And I hadn't played anything since like for 3 or 4 years. And so I would like go in there, and I started playing Mass Effect, and I was just gripped. And it was 2009, so it was shortly, so it was a few years after it had been released, and like Mass Effect 2 was only a couple of years away, you know, and it brought us together. And long story short, this guy is now my husband, and I've been with him for the last like 14 years. So it, yeah, and like he would come back, because he was studying physics and I was finishing up my theater degree, so we came from sort of very different backgrounds, but he would like come in, you know, from class and he'd be like, so what are you up to? And I'm like, oh, I'm doing this. And, you know, we'd sit there and chat and bond over it. And he really helped reignite my love of games along with this game. And particularly playing Jennifer Hale's Shepard, because I played Fem Shep, and
correct
hearing
choice.
Her voice. Oh my God, the voice acting. And this was the first time voice acting like caught me. Like I was like, holy shit, these performances are breathtaking, beautiful. Like, I'm emotional, I'm crying, I'm excited. And that was even in the first game, like, and as you said, like night and day when the second one came out. And now the thing is, so after I finished this year of exchange, I had to go back to Australia because I didn't have a visa to stay. And my partner was like, well, we'll, you know, let's try long distance. And we decided to, we originally said we'll just break up, but we liked each other and we didn't want to. So I moved back to Brisbane, and life was really hard, and I was not doing well with my mental health. I was in a job I hated, and I was feeling so lost. And Mass Effect 2 came out, and suddenly I had a reason. I had something to do, something I was invested in, something that brought me joy and made me feel like I don't know. And it's so silly, but it is that like self-insert. Like, I felt like Fem Shep. I felt like I could save the universe. I was so empowering, and I was back into games again all of a sudden. Mm. Like, this had given me this gateway that all of a sudden gaming became the thing that kept me, my head above water. And I can't remember, it must have been Mass Effect 2. It came out with multiplayer, didn't it? Or was that Mass Effect 3? I should know this. This is my deep dive, my bad. But when the multiplayer came out, I had the best reason to hang out with my boyfriend online. And I sank hours into that multiplayer. Like, oh my gosh, must have been hundreds and hundreds of hours. I was obsessed. And story aside, like incredibly beautiful, gripping, moving story aside, the gameplay as well. I hadn't grown up playing shooters. Other than, like, you know, some Doom and some Wolfenstein.
Okay.
But I was not a, like, very, I was not a big shooters kind of person, but this had, like, you know, it's a, like, a tactical cover shooter. And I was like, oh, I can do this. Oh, I'm good at this. I can play these games that I previously, and to a degree because of things like Gamergate, had felt like weren't for me because I was female. And I didn't feel safe in those spaces. And suddenly I was like, no, I can hold my own with, you know, my toy gun, my online shot. So it gave me that confidence as well, and opened up more games to me. So yeah, that was very convoluted, long sort of introduction to why I got into it. But
no, that's perfect. I'm just glad that you didn't end up coming back into his dorm and finding that you're halfway through one of the romance scenes. So that was that was a relief.
No, he knows that Garrus holds my heart. I have a Garrus statue like on my desk to this day. Like, there's no competition.
Excellent choice. I'm a Miranda fan at heart, so I'll...
Yeah, look, so is my partner. I get it. I would be too, but Garrus is like the alien. I don't know why I'm attracted to it. We can't even stop me.
I think it's probably awakened many people over the past sort of decade, so I guess you're not alone in that regard. But I think for me as well, like, this was probably one of the first games or sort of series of games where I felt like... Because obviously now it's very common to hear, you know, your decisions shape what happens in a game, or your decisions have consequences. Obviously, with the Paragon and Renegade sort of arc to these games, and sort of being able to decide how you react to people, whether you, you know, choose this particular person or whether you punch the reporter in the face, or that was one of just like obviously became a big meme at the time for Mass Effect, but. It was one of the few games where I truly felt like my decisions really shaped the game. And obviously I would play games afterwards and those decisions would become a thing. Obviously it would be huge for series like the Telltale series and things going forward. But this was the first time for me where it was like, okay, if I decide to do this, something's going to happen later down the road, which may affect me or it may be good for me. So I've really got to sort of think about this and plan it out. And when I was doing my research for the series, I think I came across a quote from one of the developers of the game, and I think they said only 8% of people went the Renegade route, which I thought was very surprising, given the fact that it almost always felt very good to be a bit of a douchebag in the game, to sort of paraphrase it, I guess. But were you more Paragon or were you more Renegade?
I would always try... This happened with KOTOR as well, and like any game where I had to, you know, pick a side. I would always try to start off Renegade and I would inevitably become Paragon.
Okay.
But I think it's a lot of it is because deep down, no matter how angry you are at the world, no matter how much you want to like get into a game and be like, I'm gonna go into GTA and kill some people for no reason. At the end of the day, we do all want to be the hero. So I'm not surprised, because I bet there are a lot of people who would occasionally make a Renegade decision. And even when I was replaying it recently, I was like, nope, I'm doing it. I'm going Renegade. And I would do what I thought was a Renegade option, like in the first game, and they'd be like, here's some Paragon points. I was like, what the how did I manage that? I thought I was being a dick. Why was that a good thing? But I kind of like... I agree. I love those decisions. Like, oh, the whole decision, you know, spoilers for anyone listening, but like with Rex in the first game, like Rex and Ashley and Kaden, like deciding who to save, and then how that echoes on. And I hate Ashley because she's a space racist for obvious reasons. And I feel like they purposely made the girl the space racist because it would be a predominantly played by men. And they were like, do you save the pretty girl even though she's racist? It's a trick question, because if you do, you're going to lose Rex. Like, I feel like they caught a lot of people out. Things like that paying off so well. And then Morden in the third game, the whole, you know, it had to meet me, someone else might have gotten it wrong, like letting him go, making players let characters, beloved characters go. It's It's a bit wanky, and maybe it's because I've done theatre, but it's immersive storytelling at its finest. Like, I still cry when I think of that scene. I still feel so heartbroken about, you know, choices that were made in the game and how people, like, I romanced Liara in the first game and then I left her for Garrus in the second game and I feel so bad about these fictional characters. And I think it's a testament. For me, this trilogy was a turning point, you know, the terrible ending aside. It was a turning point for the expansiveness of storytelling in games. It paved the way for things like Red Dead, and even the way God of War then went on. Like, games became so much more intense.
Yes.
And I think they were a big part of that.
Yeah, no, like, I definitely agree with the way that, you know, the development of storytelling through, you know, games as a medium, I think, has definitely developed since, you know, the start of Mass Effect going on to, like, recently in the last few years, I've loved The Last of Us, and obviously with the TV show going gangbusters is obviously, a big showcase of the storytelling power and the strength that series has. And but even the first game when it came out, I was like, okay, well, this was a bit of a departure and definitely what I wasn't expecting. But I mean, even, you know, before that, the Uncharted series was such a delightful jaunt, you know, very, you know, obviously a lot more lighthearted, very sort of Indiana Jones-esque in its approach. But the way it told the story and people in that series, you know, they developed character development and the way that they sort of evolved over the four games. And I felt like that was always such a unique way of developing characters and bringing that into The Last of Us and how Ellie and Joel, you know, grow up and develop and connect with each other, I thought was very powerful. It was just such an interesting, I guess, after all of that, the way that it ended in Mass Effect 3, I think was, obviously it's divided a whole lot of people and the backlash that it created all the way to, you know, adding an ending or, you know, creating an extended ending because it didn't really sort of fit. Like, were you one of the people who was a little bit sort of shocked or outraged at the ending? How did you feel?
I was bawling my eyes out. My mum came in because she could hear me wailing, and she was like, what is wrong with you? And I was like, you don't understand. I was very shocked, but also I wasn't as outraged as many because I felt like there was a... Because they were like, you get to make all these decisions all the way through, and people are like, but at the end it didn't matter. And I'm like, but that's kind of a story in itself. Like, I don't think that was laziness. I think that was a way of going, like, no matter what you did, it was always going to end this way, which is a very depressing and dark thought, but also sometimes a reality. And you just basically get a different color. You get a slightly different flavor end. So I wasn't as outraged as many. Yeah, I think I would have preferred something different, but I'm also very... I respected them. They had given so much to this story. And they'd made some weird decisions, like the Terminator baby boss of, Mass Effect 2 at the end was, you know, interesting. But that mission was amazing. And the concept of having to assign people and how, you know, the suicide mission was amazing. So I trusted them. And then, of course, they released the Citadel DLC because they were like, ugh, people don't feel good about how we left things. So let's give them a little farewell. You know, they did something similar with, you know, Witcher 3, sort of throwing on that... Tucson DLC. I feel like developers do that because they're like, oh, shoot, people are really attached to these characters and I think they're going to have withdrawals. I was not as outraged as many. Of course, I was a little bit upset because I was like, I wanted my decisions to affect things differently. I wanted a more tangible split in the end. But narratively, I can still respect there not being a split.
Yeah, I think it's always a tough line to sort of toe in games where you're constantly making those decisions, whether they be good or bad, because after all that time making those decisions, you may end up at a fork in the road or where your decisions may or may not matter. And I think, you know, it's been a, I feel like we as consumers and fans of these games, I feel like sometimes we do get a little bit spoiled in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, a couple of times where I've played games like, oh, from the top of my head, like L.A. Noire, like making those decisions and making all that effort just to sort of, you know, at the end of it, figure out that you didn't really have a choice. You know, it mm-hmm. ended the way that the game wanted it to, and you've just got to suck it up and accept it. And I felt like when I was playing those games when I was younger, it was probably a little bit more difficult for me to accept. And I think now that I'm a little bit older and can sort of go, okay, well, that was probably just more their creative choice or a narrative choice. And, you know, it may explain certain things in the game. And it's like, now that I'm older, I can truly appreciate what people are doing for these games in general and what they're doing for the narrative and the characters in general. So I think, yeah, now that I'm a little bit older, I can probably appreciate it a little bit more. But I guess to round it off, I guess, you know, obviously you explained how the trilogy was able to help you connect with your now husband. But I guess in your sort of personal life, in your career, what does this trilogy mean to you, and how has it sort of impacted your life, I guess, to sum it all up?
Oh my gosh. Wow. Well, obviously, got with my partner. It reignited my love of games. It made me feel powerful. That sounds so weird, but like I took my love of games, like particularly something like FemShep, as I said, as a role model, even though you could sort of make her whatever you wanted by choices, but Jennifer Hale's performance as well. Like, I worked in theater, which was a very, like, I was one of few people who gamed. People thought I was weird. I was a bit of an outsider. And I felt powerful in knowing that I had this safe place to go to. And it reignited that, like, yeah, I'm valid. And these games are part of who I am. Like, things like this matter to me. And this is good storytelling. I know what good storytelling is. And then years later, when I ended up being a voice actor, I was like, well, a big part of that was like, yeah, I want to be like Jennifer Hale. I want to be like she is a huge role model for me. And that continues now. And I still look back when I play that game and I listen to all their performances. I'm floored, and it's still an inspiration, and it challenges me to do better in my own work.
That's perfect. I think you couldn't have summed it up any better. And I think the game is obviously an inspiration to many, but I think the way that it sort of inspired you to create your own work, and I think that's really powerful. And I think it hopefully does the same for a lot of other people going forward. But yeah, that's a perfect way to sum it up. But yeah, that is pretty much it, ladies and gentlemen. But I should thank my guest, Rhiannon Marshall, for coming on today's episode. Rhiannon, is there any particular places where people can find your work? Is there a Twitter account or a website that people can follow?
Yeah, of course. You can catch me at my website, which is my name, which is a pain to spell, so you might want to check the notes, but it's www.rhiannonmarshall.com. But if you want to check in with what I'm doing, I'm regular on Twitter at rsmarshall, and LinkedIn as well if you're a businessy type. Weird how LinkedIn is thoroughly useful in the voiceover world. Still blows my mind.
Yeah, no, I'm finding it's very powerful in the last year or so. So I'm definitely in that particular boat as well. But yes, of course, if you'd like to follow what we're doing here at One Perfect Game, you can always do so on Twitter at OPGPod. You can always follow me on Twitter at It's Tilby. But that is it for another episode of One Perfect Game. It is so, so good to be back in your ears after our hiatus. And let's we'll finish it there from myself, Matt Tilby, and my very special guest, Rhiannon Marshall. It is goodbye for now. Take care.
Bye.